This is case 68053, Mindenhall versus, is it Tassinari? With that, if the parties wish to reserve any time, please so state. If we're ready to begin, please so. Please go.
Good morning, Your Honors. Mike Eccles for the appellants. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This is a case involving a dismissal of the district court based upon claim preclusion. And I think the threshold issue here is under which procedural rule was the case disposed of. Although there were a lot of information attached to the pleadings, it doesn't look like Judge Baer, who was a judge in the second case, ever converted this to a summary judgment order. The reason that's important is because if this truly was an NRCP 12B5 dismissal, we're entitled, under a whole host of authority, the one we cited in our brief, Stubbs versus Strickland, we're entitled to have our allegations in the complaint taken as true. What Judge Baer did here in his dismissal order is it's kind of a hybrid that actually favored the defendants. He believed some of their statements that were made by counsel, which don't have any support in the record, and he discredited our affidavits. We have supported affidavits that were attached to our opposition to motion to dismiss. And so if we look at it as a motion to dismiss order, then we should win under Stubbs. If you look at it under a Rule 56 summary judgment order, we should win based upon the existence of factual issues.
Can I ask you this, Mr. Eccles? For me, kind of the key issue in this case is the interpretation of the Waddell case and the privies and all that. Why don't you give me your take on that? Maybe Mr. Santoro would do that, how we would interpret that case.
Okay, so Waddell versus Sharp was a case that was never raised or discussed in the district court. I think the timing was off a little bit. I think Waddell did not come out until after the dismissal order was entered, which is why Five Star was the discussion in the district court, why we discussed Five Star in our opening brief. So Weddle has a new element, and I think it changes the Five Star factors. So here's where I think there's a problem for the defense. The defendant can demonstrate that he or she should have been included as a defendant in the earlier suit. The plaintiff failed to provide a good reason for not having done so. So the burden falls on the defendant here to prove the non-mutual claim preclusion. That's an inquiry that honestly was never done in the district court. And our position on that is if the defense needs Weddle to win this case, then it actually the order should be vacated and remanded for reconsideration in light of Weddle.
Let me ask you this. In the original complaint before Judge Israel, was it Judge Israel
who
had the first one? What was the contest over? There was a suit for breach of contract, and what was the defense to the breach of contract claim?
So Sunridge and Bob Mendenhall, the appellants in this case, were the defendants in that other case. And so it was breach of contract because we had signed an agreement, or I guess it was a term sheet, to pledge acres of land to build a casino.
Right, I understand that, but legally, on what basis were you denying liability on the contract claim? Not you, but your clients.
One of the arguments is that the term sheet was not binding, based upon it not being an actual contract, an offer, an acceptance, et cetera. Kind of like a letter of intent, but not reaching the full status
of the
contract.
An agreement to agree kind of thing?
Yes, Your Honor. So that's when the way the facts go, we issued the offer of judgment. It's still up in the air. It's irrevocable during the 10 days. We're in the middle of, at the end of the discovery period. Take Tassinari's deposition. Hey, look at this term sheet.
No, I understand that. What I'm trying to get at is you could have defeated liability on the contract claim had you known early enough that the signature of the other investors on the term sheet was a fraud. It misrepresented that more people were interested in this project than were truly ready to dig into their jeans and come up with money.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And that's your position in this case. But would that not have been a defense to contract liability in the first case?
Well, I guess you have to look at it and say, are the parties to this appeal, AVB and Tassinari, were they parties to the first case?
Because no, I don't, because I'm trying to get at a different point, which is, even if they weren't parties to the first case, if you were able to establish that their agents fraudulently represented that there were investors who didn't exist and yet signed as if they did exist and led you to sign that contract, fraud in the inducement type of claim, you could have avoided contract liability, right?
It's possible, Your Honor. And I think the leap that would have to be taken by the defense, which is actually the plaintiffs in the first case, would be that the Brownstone entities, the Brownstone Goldtown entities, actually knew what was going on with Tassinari and AVB, because they're the ones who committed the fraud, according to our complaint, in the second case. And so as long as we had that connection between all the entities, then yes, we could have, had we known in time, because fraud can defeat a contract.
What should one do, though, in this case, not dealing with the parties, but the issue of compulsory versus permissive claims? How does that stack up in this?
Okay, so the way that we looked at that, Your Honor, is the compulsory counterclaim, and it doesn't fit into the rule perfectly because we were defendants and we dealt with some different parties. But the way we dealt with that is, the way the case law lines up is, it talks about maturity. At what point in time did we know that we had the ability to allege a counterclaim for fraud? Some of the federal cases we looked at, some of the state cases, they say it has to be at the outset of the case. But if you go back to the five-star or the Weddle factors, there has to be, at some point, we have to be able to allege those. We can't just say, hypothetically, in a vacuum, we could have alleged our four fraud claims. But when could we actually have done those? And there really was no point in time in the Judge Israel, the first Judge Israel case, when we could have done that. Another argument we put in our briefs is, well, under Rule 11, we can't just go alleging fraud as a defense at the outset of a case. And plus we have Rule 9 where we'd have to put particularity or be subject to dismissal. So
even if a party is held liable on a contract, you would say that the party is not precluded. Like, let's say you didn't find out about the fraud until 2 years later. The alleged fraud, I'm not finding fraud, but you could then sue on your fraud claim?
Well, I think
Could you sue the guy who sued you in contract, who got paid on the contract?
If it was the same parties, Your Honor, I think then we're probably into the Bonnell v. Lawrence.
Yeah, so you would have to come in and do the set aside the judgment in order to go against the same party.
Yes. And so if we're beyond the 6 months of 60B, then it would have to be an independent action because of limitations.
And it would have to be a beggarly, extraordinary,
exactly,
heaven and earth kind of fraud. But it's troubling to me that the contract claim reaches a judgment and fraud in the inducement would have been a defense to the contract claim, that that's not resolved at the point of that judgment.
It's not, because we had actually put on OST, a motion to amend, which our third-party complaint was basically a carbon copy, yeah, of the complaint in the second case. And what Judge Israel did is he said, because there was an acceptance of an offer of judgment, he vacated, took off calendar our OST.
They make a point in their briefs, and I didn't see that you answered it, and I didn't pull the transcript, but they say that we don't have in the record the oral statement from Judge Israel about you can sue in another action and deal with it there, that all we have are lawyers talking to Judge Baer in the second case. Are they correct on that?
They are correct, and here's what happened with that. We received the case. We said, hey, everybody's talking about what Judge Israel said. Lawyers from both sides talked about what Judge Israel said, including the new action. So we called Chambers, said, do you guys have the jazz video? They said it's not available. Was there a reporter or a recorder? Not available either. Had that been available, we might have tried to stipulate or move the court to include it under a judicial notice or something like that.
Because okay, that was exactly what I was wondering.
Because instead of talking about what he said, it would be nice to know what did he say? Because none of us were there, none of the counsel.
Because it could have been a whole type.
Mr. Marquis was. But anyways, nobody's disagreed with that Judge Israel, when he denied the motion for clarification, said, if you want relief, you need to go elsewhere because you're not getting it here, kind of a statement. Now, the problem with that order is it was not an appealable order. Otherwise, we would have just appealed that and we didn't need to worry about the second case. And it wasn't even our motion either, because our motion, he had taken off calendar, but he heard what was the motion to enforce / clarify. And the interesting thing about the order that came out of that, which was the judgment that was entered on the offer of judgment, the judgment is entered, and then it says only as to these parties. And so I don't know guessing what Judge Israel was thinking, but just looking at the plain language of the order, it wouldn't apply to these new parties based upon that carve-out. And if there are no other questions, I'll reserve my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Justices. Nick Santoro appearing on behalf of the respondents. Harry Marquis is with me today. Harry was a trial counsel in both of the underlying actions. So if there are any questions about these comments with Judge Israel, Mr. Marquis can respond to those. What I'd like to talk about today, and I know that we've briefed the claim preclusion issue extensively, there's something else I'd like to start with that I think is very important here. There's not one but two public policies that are at stake in this case today, Justices. Not only the finality of judgments, which is claim preclusion, preventing multiplicity of litigation, preventing inconsistent decisions. So we have that at stake. But equally important, what we have at stake here is the policy about promoting resolution of cases, encouraging parties to settle their disputes prior to trial, because, of course, if every case had to be tried, it would cripple the judicial system. And let's not forget that this was a case that was settled. No judge, Judge Israel, did not require the appellants in this case to pay $1.2 million. The appellants themselves offered to pay $1.2 million. We accepted. That was a settlement. Now, of course, it became a judgment later, and you get into claim preclusion with the bar of a judgment. But the policy of settlement, encouraging resolution of cases, is as important in this case as is the policy behind claim preclusion. Now, when they settled this case, and this goes for any case, as the offeror, they chose not only the amount of the settlement, they chose the timing of the settlement. They were the master of their offer. They decided, we're going to offer $1.2 million, and very importantly here, Justices, we're going to offer that $1.2 million at a point in the litigation before we've taken the key depositions, including the deposition of Tassinari, where they say they learned this new fact. I'm going to touch on that a little bit later. But in terms of the timing, this litigation went on for about 2.5 years. Okay? The transaction was back from 07.
Should we give any credence to the point that Mr. Eccles made in terms of the order indicated it was limited to the parties?
I'm sorry?
It was limited to the parties so named?
That's where you get into the claim preclusion aspect. It's the parties or the privies, any part of the claims that were brought or could have been brought in those cases. So you get into the questions of, were they privies?
You want to open the door completely then?
No, Your Honor. What I will argue to you is that they were not only privies, but I believe under Five Star, there was claim preclusion here, and that's what Judge Baer ruled upon. But under Weddle, even more so.
But you started going down that line that they knew what was going on. They should have, I guess, looked at the global situation. And then we get back into this compulsory versus permissive situation and looking at what's going on.
I think my point here, Justice Douglas, is that they chose when to make this offer and when to settle the case. If they didn't feel like they had all the facts necessary upon which to offer $1.2 million because they hadn't taken the key depositions, then they shouldn't have made the offer at that point in time.
Let me move you off that point, though. Let's assume this case went to verdict and judgment and was not a settled case,
yes,
but that everything else is the same. In other words, you sued them for breach of contract. They asserted whatever denials of liability they had, and it went through to judgment. They lost and had to pay you $1.2 million, so you had a final judgment.
Yes.
And then they discover that there was fraud in the inducement that they didn't previously know, and except for the moment that that's true, they discover it.
Yes.
Would that judgment make your argument for that judgment precluding their claims against the agents who allegedly connived to defraud them under the contract and then ultimately of their litigation position?
Well, I guess there's two responses, Justice Pickering. If the obviously the first avenue of relief for them was 60B, Rule 60B motion, and the Nava versus district court case is very instructive here because it's very similar. The same thing happened. In Nava, the plaintiff, it was a personal injury case, made an offer of judgment in a certain amount. During the 10-day period, the plaintiff discovered that he was going to need back surgery or something like that, that the damages would be higher. Tried to revoke the offer of judgment. In between, the other side accepted the offer of judgment, and a judgment is entered. It goes up on appeal. Nevada Supreme Court said, although the offer of judgment is irrevocable during the 10-day period, your remedy, so a judgment gets entered, your remedy is to file a Rule 60B motion, okay? Which is what, in fact, should have happened here, Your Honor, because I think this is very significant. Had they filed a Rule 60B motion, let's kind of play the whole thing out.
Yes, exactly.
Because I think this is very instructive for the court. If they filed a Rule 60B motion, they go back in front of Judge Israel. It was the judge that heard the case. He was closest to it.
They say there was fraud. We discovered
it. It was fraud. Whatever they want to say, I mean, there's going to be a number of arguments there. One of them is fraud, but that's one of the 60B 1 through 3 grounds, okay? So they could have taken that to Judge Israel. Now, they would have had to answer some tough questions in that case. Why didn't you discover it before? Because, Justice Pickering, you're 100% right. That's a defense to the underlying case. So if you felt there was some question about this these signatures on this document, why didn't you ask the question at any time before? When they asked the question finally during depo, they were told whose signature it was. So they should have litigated that in front of Judge Israel. They would have had to answer some tough questions. Why did you make your offer before you took the depositions? Why didn't you do any discovery to find these things out sooner? Okay, but Judge Israel decides. And if he decides they don't make it under 60B, it's case over. Okay?
But pause with me for a moment. Let's say they lost at their contract claim, can they sue an agent and say, hey, you caused me to lose my contract case because you connived and fraudulently represented that there were investors that don't really exist?
Well, I guess I have two answers to that as well, Your Honor. That number one is, in an independent action, we get into Bunnell.
Yeah.
And I don't think they come.
Well, you get into Begley, but.
Right. Cited by Bunnell. You know, the rare and exceptional circumstance of the grave miscarriage of justice. And here I would submit there's none of that simply because it was a defense that was always out there that they didn't attempt to discover until after they made an offer to settle the case. So I think they would have a very difficult time filing an independent action. And moreover, this brings us all the way back to square one. Under Weddle, under privy analysis, five star, and under Weddle, they can't do that. Bear in mind, these parties, these new parties.
James and I were in the dissent in Waddell. But,
I know very well about that. I spent some time reading Waddell.
But it's binding on us, so we have to.
I understand that, too. But Your Honor, in your dissenting opinion, you said the claim against the arbitrators for fraud in the arbitration process was logically distinct from the claim that the two business partners had. And I happen to agree with you. In this case, there is no distinction. This was the same case. Think about this. The contract upon which the case was brought was signed by the same parties. They now want to say were new parties to the case. They signed it. Right in there, you've got a representation that American Vantage Brownstone is the parent of the Brownstone entity that was a plaintiff, and that Tassinari
was the chairman of American Vantage Brownstone. They all signed the document. So for them to say that these are new parties and they couldn't have known any of this, I respectfully have to disagree. All they really needed to do was to ask a question. Okay, who signed this other signature block? Okay, they never did that. Instead, they chose to settle the case when they chose to settle the case. But if I can come back for a moment on the Rule 60B, they go in front of Judge Israel. If he grants it, if they can make their case, and I don't think they could, because I think they have a lot of explaining to do, but let's say they make their case. So now what Judge Israel does is he sets aside the judgment. At least at that point in time, all the parties are restored to the position that they occupied before the judgment was entered. And at least at that point in time, my clients, when they settled the case for $1.2 million, they left a lot of money on the table. Okay, they made a choice as well, not just them. Settlements, there's risk. They left a lot of money on the table when they settled for $1.2 million. So think about this. They don't seek to set aside the judgment, and they didn't. They didn't at all. In fact, when they say this should be construed as a 60B motion, I take issue with that. In their opposition to the motion to dismiss the underlying case, this is page 125 of the appendix, the last two sentences before the conclusion on page 15, any judgment obtained by the Sunridge parties against defendants in this action, number two, will not result in an inconsistent decision obtained in the first action. In fact, the judgment in this action, case two, will have no bearing whatsoever on any decisions made in the first action. So expressly, what they are saying in case two is, we're not trying to set that aside. They said that, so it can't be construed as 60B. They didn't want to set it aside. What they want, and this is where I take issue with the way this has come down, they want it both ways. They want the preclusive effect of a judgment that prohibits my client from seeking the full amount of its damages when it's settled for only a fraction of that at $1.2 million, and at the same time, they take a free roll of the dice to try to get back the $1.2 million it paid in settlement. And if that's going to be the policy, justices, then what I would suggest to you is there's going to be a lot of defendants who will try to settle a case for as low up as possible as they can, gin up some new fact that they could have discovered before but didn't, okay, for whatever reason, and then file a new lawsuit just to get the money back while the plaintiff in the first case is still precluded because there's a judgment under that they're going to hold up saying, hey, there's claim preclusion here. You cannot seek any more than what you settled for. You took the risk of settling the case, they would say to us, and I would say, you know what, you're probably right, but you took the risk that you're not able to relitigate this case any further. That you're going to find some new fact that you might have been a defense to the underlying case. So if we're barred, you're barred. What they want is, we're barred, they're not barred. That can't possibly be the rule here, justices. So I really think that under
your point, Mr. Santoro, is you've capped the amount you can seek and all like that. So it's fair to be binding on both parties.
That's exactly my point, Justice Gibbons. If you play this all the way out, that's why they went about this the wrong way, in a way that will result in a very, very unfair decision to my client. I heard the beep. I don't know that I'm...
You still have 318, 317.
Okay. So in terms of claim preclusion, so I think that really is my main argument. I think that illustrates why you can't do what they're trying to do in this case, because it's just totally unfair. And they had a remedy. They just chose not to avail themselves of it. But under claim preclusion, right, this case was decided under Five Star because Weddle hadn't come down yet. So Judge Baer decided under the more rigid standard of Five Star. I think the only real issue here, justices, is whether the defendants in the second case were the privies of the parties in the first case, or under Weddle, if there was a close and significant relationship and there was no good reason why they shouldn't have been named in the first case. But in terms of the other elements, valid judgment, the same claims or any part of them that were made or could have been made, as Ronna points out, Justice Pickering, this could have been made as a defense to the underlying case. So you get down to this prong of our claim preclusion, and what I would point to is two documents that are in this record. The term sheet, as I pointed out, the term sheet is the very subject. That was the contract on which the first case was brought, It's signed by all of these parties. There's no one new. They all signed it, and their capacities are all disclosed in it. So they can't take the position they didn't know. But if that weren't enough, as Mr. Eccles said...
But Tassinari signed it as a representative of one of the entities, not individually, right?
Not individually. As the chairman of American Vantage Brownstone, which is the parent of Brownstone Goldtown, the plaintiff.
Yeah. Okay?
So there's that close and significant relationship, clearly. And their interests are all aligned, clearly. But if that weren't enough, as Mr. Eccles points out, they filed a proposed amended pleading, whereby, you know, when you say, could you have brought those claims in case one? Well, that's exactly what they tried to do. They tried to amend to state an answer, a counterclaim, and a third-party complaint against all these parties. And here's the allegation that Tassinari, in his individual capacity and in his representative capacity, on behalf of the Brownstone entities and American Vantage, made certain misrepresentations to them on which they relied. Justices, if they can sue Tassinari in his representative capacity and impute liability to the other three entities, if that relationship is so close where his statements can impute liability to them, how could there not be privity going back the other way by their own statements? Not only the fact that it's in the term sheet, but by their own claims that they tried to bring in the first case, clearly there was privity here. The only issue here was they made their settlement offer before they took the deposition. That's not our fault that they did that. I want to address my very brief amount of time left. Justice Douglas, you asked about compulsory counterclaims. I want to answer that question. In this record, twice in their motion to amend, they said, and it's page 50 and page 50, either 1 or 52 of the appendix, they said that this case arises out of the same set of operative facts, okay, the new FAR claims, and it involves the same transaction or occurrence. I don't know a better definition for a compulsory counterclaim. So I think the issue is somewhat moot because it would have been a compulsory counterclaim, but moreover, well expanded, I believe, the rules so that it didn't have to just be a compulsory counterclaim. I mean, you can extend it to non-parties in certain circumstances. So I believe I'm out of time now.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Eccles, I'm concerned. I know you've got some arguments to address. I'll be quick because there's 4 minutes left. What about this? They're kind of arguing they've been sandbagged. They accepted the offer of judgment, resolved the case. It's capped, and now they're getting collaterally attacked here. What's your position on that?
Well, I think the public policy that counsel talks about of resolving cases is undermined by his own argument with Nava versus District Court, because Nava says, no, you can't attack those settlements under 60B. 60B also allows for the independent action, and we already kind of talked about how this wasn't a 60B case because Judge Israel sent us on our way. To the issue of can Tassinari be liable separately in fraud, for our four fraud claims in the new case. The case we cited, Nevada Texas Oil and Gas versus Precision Rolled Products, says an agent who fraudulently makes representations is liable in tort to the injured person, although the fraud occurs in a transaction on behalf of the principal. That's Nevada law, Your Honor. And so there's no cloak of protection here for fraud, even based on this Nevada law. We don't have to go anywhere else. On the issue of, now here's something that's interesting, back to my point at the beginning of my argument about a 12B5 order. So there are some findings in here. This is paragraph 5 on page 245 of the record. AVB managed, led, owned, and acted on behalf of the two Brownstone entities. Where do we get that from? There's no evidence in the record of that, and I don't even know how that came to be. And so there's clearly some discovery issues, which based upon the Rocker case, because this is their company, we'd be entitled to. One thing I want to point out is counsel said that all the parties signed the term sheet or the contract or whatever you want to call it. Now, although AVB signed the contract, it was really more of an acknowledgement The entire term sheet is attached to our complaint as an exhibit. And it does have the signature block on there. But if you read the whole term sheet, there's no duties or obligations for AVB. All it is an acknowledgement that, hey, this is a parent company, and it must be some company policy that if there's a subsidiary that signs this type of agreement, we need an acknowledgement from the parent. But there's no duties or obligations from AVB. So the privity issue is not so close as because of that.
Would you say then that if entity is sued, your client is sued and it went through to judgment, same hypothetical I was talking to Mr. Santoro about, they recover $1.2 million after jury trial on their contract claim, and your client has to pay it, can you then sue their agent for fraud?
I think based upon this Nevada-Texas oil case, I think I can, as long as it's within 3 years, statute of limitations.
Okay, so that's the proposition of law you're putting forward, is that claim preclusion in a straight-up breach of contract action where you deny liability, and then afterwards you discover that somebody misrepresented something causing fraud in the inducement of the contract, you can sue the agent individually and not be precluded. That's your proposition of law?
Yes, Your Honor. So one other case I want to point out, Bankers Trust versus Pacific Employers Insurance Company. It's a Ninth Circuit case applying Nevada law from 1960. In that case, the Ninth Circuit differentiated the defense of a breach of contract case versus a fraud case. And so when we want to just throw all these claims into a big ball of wax and say it's all the same for purposes of a five-star or Weddle analysis, I don't think that's accurate. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. The court thanks counsel for arguments off of this day. Shed light on things of interest for this court. This case, 68053, will stand submitted. The call.